brains of others without then storing it in your own brain and quickly overloading its capacity. Bliss said, I don't know, Trevise, any more than you know the detailed workings of your single brain. I presume you know the distance from your sun to a neighboring star, but you are not always conscious of it. You store it somewhere, and can retrieve the figure at any time if asked. If not asked, you may with time forget it, but you can then always retrieve it from some data bank. If you consider Gaia's brain a vast data bank, it is one I can call on. But there is no need for me to remember consciously any particular item I have made use of. Once I have made use of a fact or memory, I can allow it to pass out of memory. For that matter, I can deliberately put it back, so to speak, in the place I got it from. How many people on Gaia, Bliss? How many human beings? About 1 billion. Do you want the exact figure as of now? Trevise smiled ruefully. I quite see you can call up the exact figure if you wish, but I'll take the approximation. Actually, said Bliss, the population is stable and oscillates about a particular number that is slightly in excess of 1 billion. I can tell by how much the number exceeds or falls short of the mean by extending my consciousness and, well, feeling the boundaries. I can't explain it better than that to someone who has never shared the experience. It seems to me, however, that 1 billion human minds, a number of them being those of children, are surely not enough to hold in memory all the data needed by a complex society. But human beings are not the only living things on Gaia, Trev. Do you mean that animals remember too? Non-human brains can't store memories with the same density human brains can, and much of the room in all brains, human and non-human alike, must be given over to personal memories, which are scarcely useful except to the particular component of the planetary consciousness that harbors them. However, significant quantities of advanced data can be, and are, stored in animal brains, also in plant tissue, and in the mineral structure of the planet. In the mineral structure? The rocks and mountain range, you mean? And, for some kinds of data, the ocean and atmosphere. All that is Gaia, too. But what can non-living systems hold? A great deal. The intensity is low, but the volume is so great that a large majority of Gaia's total memory is in its rocks. It takes a little longer to retrieve and replace rock memories, so that it is the preferred place for storing dead data, so to speak. Items that, in the normal course of events, would rarely be called upon. What happens when someone dies whose brain stores data of considerable value? The data is not lost. It is slowly crowded out as the brain disorganizes after death, but there is ample time to distribute the memories into other parts of Gaia. And as new brains appear in babies and become more organized with growth, they not only develop their personal memories and thoughts, but are fed appropriate knowledge from other sources. What you would call education is entirely automatic with me, us, Gaia. Hellerat said, Frankly, Golan, it seems to me that this notion of a living world has a great deal to be said for it. Trevise gave his fellow Foundationer a brief sidelong glance. I'm sure of that, Janoff, but I'm not impressed. The planet, however big and however diverse, represents one brain. One. Every new brain that arises is melted into the whole. Where's the opportunity for opposition, for disagreement? When you think of human history, You think of the occasional human being whose minority view may be condemned by society, but who wins out in the end and changes the world. What chance is there on Gaia for the great rebels of history? There is internal conflict, said Bliss. Not every aspect of Gaia necessarily accepts the common view. It must be limited, said Trevise. You cannot have too much turmoil within a single organism, or it would not work properly. If progress and development are not stopped altogether, they must certainly be slowed. Can we take the chance of inflicting that on the entire galaxy, on all of humanity? Bliss said without open emotion, Are you now questioning your own decision? Are you changing your mind? And are you now saying that Gaia is an undesirable future for humanity? Trevise tightened his lips and hesitated. Then he said slowly, I would like to, but not yet. I made my decision on some basis, some unconscious basis. And until I find out what that basis was, I cannot truly decide whether I am to maintain or change my decision. Let us therefore return to the matter of Earth. Where you feel you will learn the nature of the basis on which you made your decision. Is that it, Trevise? That is the feeling I have. Now, Dome says Gaia does not know the location of Earth, and you agree with him, I believe. Of course I agree with him. I am no less Gaia than he is. And do you withhold knowledge from me? Consciously, I mean? Of course not. Even if it were possible for Gaia to lie, it would not lie to you. Above all, we depend upon your conclusions, and we need them to be accurate, and that requires that they be based on reality. In that case, said Trevise, let's make use of your world memory. Probe backward and tell me how far you can remember. There was a small hesitation. Bliss looked blankly at Trevise, as though for a moment she was in a trance. Then she said, 15,000 years. Why did you hesitate? It took time. Old memories, really old, are almost all in the mountain roots where it takes time to dig them out. 15,000 years ago, then, is that when Gaia was settled? No. To the best of our knowledge, that took place some 3,000 years before that. Why are you uncertain? Don't you, or Gaia, remember? Bliss said, That was before Gaia had developed to the point where memory became a global phenomenon. Yet before you could rely on your collective memory, Gaia must have kept records, Bliss. Records in the usual sense. Recorded, written, filmed, and so on. I imagine so, but they could scarcely endure all this time. They could have been copied, or better yet, transferred into the global memory once that was developed. Bliss frowned. There was another hesitation, longer this time. I find no sign of these earlier records you speak of. Why is that? I don't know, Trevise. I presume that they proved of no great importance. I imagine that by the time it was understood that the early non-memory records were decaying, it was decided that they had grown archaic and were not needed. You don't know that. You presume and you imagine, but you don't know that. Gaia doesn't know that. Bliss's eyes fell. It must be so. Must be? I am not a part of Gaia. And therefore I need not presume what Gaia presumes, which gives you an example of the importance of isolation. I, as an isolate, presume something else. What do you presume? First, there is something I am sure of. A civilization in being is not likely to destroy its early records. Far from judging them to be archaic and unnecessary, they are likely to treat them with exaggerated reverence and would labor to preserve them. If Gaia's pre-global records were destroyed, Bliss, that destruction was not likely to be voluntary. How would you explain it, then? In the library at Trantor, all references to Earth were removed by someone or some force other than that of the Trantorian Second Foundationers themselves. Isn't it possible, then, that on Gaia II, all references to Earth were removed by something other than Gaia itself? How do you know the early records involved Earth? According to you, Gaia was founded at least 18,000 years ago. That brings us back to the period before the establishment of the Galactic Empire, to the period when the galaxy was being settled. And the prime source of settlers was Earth. Pellerat will confirm that. Pellerat, caught a little by surprise by suddenly being called on, cleared his throat. So go the legends, my dear. I take those legends seriously, and I think, as Golan Travis does, that the human species was originally confined to a single planet, and that planet was Earth. The earliest settlers came from Earth. If then, said Travis, Gaia was founded in the early days of hyperspatial travel, then it is very likely to have been colonized by Earthmen, or possibly by natives of a not very old world that had not long before been colonized by Earthmen. For that reason, the records of Gaia's settlement and of the first few millennia thereafter must clearly have involved Earth and Earthmen, and those records are gone. Something seems to be seeing to it that Earth is not mentioned anywhere in the records of the galaxy, and if so, there must be some reason for it. Bliss said indignantly, "This is conjecture, Travis. You have no evidence for this." "But it is Gaia that insists that my special talent is that of coming to correct conclusions on the basis of insufficient evidence. If, then, I come to a firm conclusion, don't tell me I lack evidence." Bliss was silent. Travis went on. "All the more reason, then, for finding Earth. I intend to leave as soon as the far star is ready. Do you two still want to come?" "Yes," said Bliss at once. And "yes," said Pellerat. Chapter 2. Toward Camporeon. 5. It was raining lightly. Travis looked up at the sky, which was a solid, grayish white. He was wearing a rain hat that repelled the drops and sent them flying well away from his body in all directions. Pellerat, standing out of range of the flying drops, had no such protection. Travis said, "I don't see the point of your letting yourself get wet, Janoff." "The wet doesn't bother me, my dear chap," said Pellerat, looking as solemn as he always did. "It's a light and warm rain. There's no wind to speak of. And besides, to quote the old saying, in Anacreon, do as the Anacreonians do." He indicated the few Gaians standing near the far star, watching quietly. They were well scattered, as though they were trees in a Gaian grove, and none wore rain hats. "I suppose," said Travis, "they don't mind being wet because all the rest of Gaia is getting wet. The trees, the grass, the soil, all wet, and all equally part of Gaia, along with the Gaians." "I think it makes sense," said Pellerat. "The sun will come out soon enough, and everything will dry quickly. The clothing won't wrinkle or shrink. There's no chilling effect. And since there aren't any unnecessary pathogenic microorganisms, no one will get colds or flu or pneumonia. Why worry about a bit of damp, then? Trevise had no trouble in seeing the logic of that, but he hated to let go of his grievance. He said, "Still, there is no need for it to rain as we are leaving. After all, the rain is voluntary. Gaia wouldn't rain if it didn't want to. It's almost as though it were showing its contempt for us." "Perhaps," and Pelleret's lip twitched a bit, "Gaia is weeping with sorrow at our leaving." Trevise said, "That may be, but I'm not." "Actually," Pelleret went on, "I presume that the soil in this region needs a wetting down, and that need is more important than your desire to have the sunshine." Trevise smiled. "I suspect you really like this world, don't you? Even aside from bliss, I mean." "Yes, I do," said Pelleret, a trace defensively. "I've always led a quiet, orderly life. And think how I could manage here, with a whole world laboring to keep it quiet and orderly. After all, Golan, when we build a house, or that ship, we try to create a perfect shelter. We equip it with everything we need. We arrange to have its temperature, air quality, illumination, and everything else of importance controlled by us and manipulated in a way to make it perfectly accommodating to us. Gaia is just an extension of the desire for comfort and security extended to an entire planet. What's wrong with that?" "What's wrong with that," said Trevise, "is that my house or my ship is engineered to suit me. I am not engineered to suit it. If I were part of Gaia, then no matter how ideally the planet was devised to suit me, I would be greatly disturbed over the fact that I was also being devised to suit it." Pelleret pursed his lips. "One could argue that every society molds its population to fit itself. Customs develop that make sense within the society, and that chain every individual firmly to its needs. In the societies I know, one can revolt. There are eccentrics, even criminals." "Do you want eccentrics and criminals?" "Why not? You and I are eccentrics. We're certainly not typical of the people living on Terminus. As for criminals, that's a matter of definition. And if criminals are the price we must pay for rebels, heretics, and geniuses, I'm willing to pay it. I demand the price be paid." "Are criminals the only possible payment? Can't you have genius without criminals?" "You can't have geniuses and saints without having people far outside the norm. And I don't see how you can have such things on only one side of the norm. There is bound to be a certain symmetry. In any case, I want a better reason for my decision to make Gaia the model for the future of humanity than that it is a planetary version of a comfortable house." "Oh, my dear fellow, I wasn't trying to argue you into being satisfied with your decision. I was just making an observation." He broke off. Bliss was striding toward them, her dark hair wet and her robe clinging to her body and emphasizing the rather generous width of her hips. She was nodding to them as she came. "I'm sorry I delayed you," she said, panting a little. "It took longer to check with Dome than I had anticipated." "Surely," said Trevise, "you know everything he knows." "Sometimes it's a matter of difference in interpretation. We are not identical after all, so we discuss. Look here," she said with a touch of asperity. "You have two hands. They are each part of you, and they seem identical, except for one being the mirror image of the other. Yet you do not use them entirely alike, do you? There are some things you do with your right hand most of the time, and some with your left. Differences in interpretation, so to speak.
She's got you, said Pellerat, with obvious satisfaction.
Trevise nodded. It's an effective analogy, if it were relevant, and I'm not at all sure it is. In any case, does this mean we can board the ship now? It is raining.
Yes. Yes, our people are all off it, and it's in perfect shape.
Then, with a sudden curious look at Trevise, you're keeping dry. The raindrops are missing you.
Yes, indeed, said Trevise. I am avoiding wetness.
But doesn't it feel good to be wet now and then?
Absolutely, but at my choice, not the rain's.
Bliss shrugged.
Well, as you please. All our baggage is loaded, so let's board.
The three walked toward the Far Star. The rain was growing still lighter, but the grass was quite wet. Trevise found himself walking gingerly, but Bliss had kicked off her slippers, which she was now carrying in one hand, and was slogging through the grass barefoot.
It feels delightful, she said, in response to Trevise's downward glance.
Good, he said absently. Then, with a touch of irritation, why are those other Gaians standing about anyway?
Bliss said, they're recording this event, which Gaia finds momentous. You are important to us, Trevise. Consider that if you should change your mind as a result of this trip and decide against us, we would never grow into Galaxia, or even remain as Gaia.
Then I represent life and death for Gaia, for the whole world?
We believe so.
Trevise stopped suddenly and took off his rain hat. Blue patches were appearing in the sky. He said, but you have my vote in your favor now. If you kill me, I'll never be able to change it.
Golan, murmured Pellerat, shocked. That is a terrible thing to say.
Typical of an isolate, said Bliss calmly. You must understand, Trevise, that we are not interested in you as a person, or even in your vote, but in the truth, in the facts of the matter. You are only important as a conduit to the truth, and your vote as an indication of the truth. That is what we want from you. And if we kill you to avoid a change in your vote, we would merely be hiding the truth from ourselves.
If I tell you the truth is non-Gaia, will you all then cheerfully agree to die?
Not entirely cheerfully, perhaps, but it's what it would amount to in the end.
Trevise shook his head. If anything ought to convince me that Gaia is a horror and should die, it might be that very statement you've just made. Then, he said, his eyes returning to the patiently watching, and presumably listening, Gaians. Why are they spread out like that? And why do you need so many? If one of them observes this event and stores it in his or her memory, isn't it available to all the rest of the planet? Can't it be stored in a million different places if you want it to be?
Bliss said, they are observing this each from a different angle, and each is storing it in a slightly different brain. When all the observations are studied, it will be seen that what is taking place will be far better understood from all the observations together than from any one of them taken singly.
The whole is greater than the sum of the parts, in other words.
Exactly. You have grasped the basic justification of Gaia's existence. You, as a human individual, are composed of perhaps 50 trillion cells. But you, as a multicellular individual, are far more important than those 50 trillion as the sum of their individual importance. Surely you would agree with that.
Yes, said Treviz. I agree with that.
He stepped into the ship and turned briefly for one more look at Gaia. The brief rain had lent a new freshness to the atmosphere. He saw a green, lush, quiet, peaceful world. A garden of serenity set amid the turbulence of the weary galaxy. And Treviz earnestly hoped he would never see it again.
6. When the airlock closed behind them, Treviz felt as though he had shut out not exactly a nightmare, but something so seriously abnormal that it had prevented him from breathing freely. He was fully aware that an element of that abnormality was still with him in the person of Bliss. While she was there, Gaia was there. And yet he was also convinced that her presence was essential. It was the black box working again. And earnestly he hoped he would never begin believing in that black box too much. He looked about the vessel and found it beautiful. It had been his only since Mayor Harlebrano of the Foundation had forced him into it and sent him out among the stars, a living lightning rod designed to draw the fire of those she considered enemies of the Foundation. That task was done, but the ship was still his, and he had no plans to return it. It had been his for merely a matter of a few months, but it seemed like home to him, and he could only dimly remember what had once been his home in Terminus. Terminus, the off-center hub of the Foundation, destined by Selden's plan to form a second and greater empire in the course of the next 5 centuries, except that he, Treviz, had now derailed it. By his own decision, he was converting the Foundation to nothing, and was making possible instead a new society, a new scheme of life, a frightening revolution that would be greater than any since the development of multicellular life. Now he was engaged in a journey designed to prove to himself, or to disprove, that what he had done was right. He found himself lost in thought and motionless, so that he shook himself in self-irritation. He hastened to the pilot room and found his computer still there. It glistened. Everything glistened. There had been a most careful cleaning. The contacts he closed nearly at random worked perfectly, and it surely seemed with greater ease than ever. The ventilating system was so noiseless that he had to put his hand over the vents to make sure he felt air currents. The circle of light on the computer glowed invitingly. Treviz touched it, and the light spread out to cover the desktop, and the outline of a right and left hand appeared on it. He drew a deep breath and realized that he had stopped breathing for a while. The Gaians knew nothing about Foundation technology, and they might easily have damaged the computer without meaning any malice. Thus far they had not. The hands were still there. The crucial test came with the laying on of his own hands, however, and for a moment he hesitated. He would know almost at once if anything were wrong. But if something was, what could he do? For repairs, he would have to go back to Terminus. And if he did, he felt quite confident that Mayor Brano would not let him leave again. And if he did not... He could feel his heart pounding, and there was clearly no point in deliberately lengthening the suspense. He thrust his hands out. Right, left, and placed them on the outlines upon the desk. At once he had the illusion of another pair of hands holding his. His senses extended, and he could see Gaia in all directions, green and moist, the Gaian still watching. When he willed himself to look upward, he saw a largely cloudy sky. Again at his will, the clouds vanished, and he looked at an unbroken blue sky, with the orb of Gaia's sun filtered out. Again he willed, and the blue parted, and he saw the stars. He wiped them out, and willed, and saw the galaxy, like a foreshortened pinwheel. He tested the computerized image,
adjusting its orientation, altering the apparent progress of time, making it spin first in one direction, then the other. He located the sun of Seychelles, the nearest important star to Gaia, then the sun of Terminus, then of Trantor, one after the other. He traveled from star to star in the galactic map that dwelt in the bowels of the computer. Then he withdrew his hands and let the world of reality surround him again, and realized he had been standing all this time, half bowing over the computer to make the hand contact. He felt stiff and had to stretch his back muscles before sitting down. He stared at the computer with warm relief. It had worked perfectly. It had been, if anything, more responsive, and what he felt for it he could only describe as love. After all, while he held its hands, he resolutely refused to admit to himself that he thought of it as her hands. They were part of each other, and his will directed, controlled, experienced, and was part of a greater self. He and it must feel in a small way, he suddenly and disturbingly thought, what Gaia did in a much larger way. He shook his head. No. In the case of the computer and himself, it was he, Trevise, who was in entire control. The computer was a thing of total submission. He rose and moved out to the compact galley and dining area. There was plenty of food of all kinds, with proper refrigeration and easy heating facilities. He had already noted that the book films in his room were in the proper order, and he was reasonably sure, no, completely sure, that Pellerad had his personal library in safe storage. He would otherwise surely have heard from him by now. Pellerad. That reminded him. He stepped into Pellerad's room. Is there room for Bliss here, Janoff? Oh, yes, quite. I can convert the common room into her bedroom. Bliss looked up wide-eyed. I have no desire for a separate bedroom. I am quite content to stay here with Pell. I suppose, though, that I may use the other rooms when needed, the gym, for instance. Certainly, any room but mine. Good. That's what I would have suggested be the arrangement if I had had the making of it. Naturally, you will stay out of ours. Naturally, said Trevise, looking down and realizing that his shoes overlapped the threshold. He took a half step backward and said grimly, These are not honeymoon quarters, Bliss.
I should say, in view of its compactness, that it is exactly that, even though Gaia extended it to half again as wide as it was.
Trevise tried not to smile. You'll have to be very friendly. We are, said Pellerat, clearly ill at ease at the topic of conversation. But really, old chap, you can leave it to us to make our own arrangements.
Actually, I can't, said Trevise slowly. I still want to make it clear that these are not honeymoon accommodations. I have no objection to anything you do by mutual consent, but you must realize that you will have no privacy. I hope you understand that, Bliss.
There is a door, said Bliss, and I imagine you will not disturb us when it is locked, short of a real emergency, that is.
Of course I won't. However, there is no soundproofing.
What you are trying to say, Trevise, said Bliss, is that you will hear quite clearly any conversation we may have and any sounds we may make in the course of sex.
Yes, that is what I'm trying to say. With that in mind, I expect you may find you will have to limit your activities here. This may discommode you, and I'm sorry, but that's the situation as it is.
Pellerat cleared his throat and said gently, Actually, Golan, this is a problem I've already had to face. You realize that any sensation Bliss experiences when together with me is experienced by all of Gaia.
I have thought of that, Janoff, said Trevise,
looking as though he were repressing a wince. I didn't intend to mention it, just in case the thought had not occurred to you.
But it did, I'm afraid, said Pellerette.
Bliss said, Don't make too much of that, Trevise. At any given moment, there may be thousands of human beings on Gaia who are engaged in sex, millions who are eating, drinking, or engaged in other pleasure-giving activities. This gives rise to a general aura of delight that Gaia feels, every part of it. The lower animals, the plants, the minerals, have their progressively milder pleasures that also contribute to a generalized joy of consciousness that Gaia feels in all its parts always, and that is unfelt in any other world.
We have our own particular joys, said Trevise, which we can share after a fashion if we wish, or keep private if we wish.
If you could feel ours, you would know how poverty-stricken you isolates are in that respect.
How can you know what we feel?
Without knowing how you feel, it is still reasonable to suppose that a world of common pleasures must be more intense than those available to a single, isolated individual.
Perhaps. But even if my pleasures were poverty-stricken, I would keep my own joys and sorrows and be satisfied with them, thin as they are, and be me, and not blood brother to the nearest rock.
Don't sneer, said Bliss. You value every mineral crystal in your bones and teeth, and would not have one of them damaged, though they have no more consciousness than the average rock crystal of the same size.
That's true enough, said Trevise reluctantly. But we've managed to get off the subject. I don't care if all Gaia shares your joy, Bliss, but I don't want to share it. We're living here in close quarters, and I do not wish to be forced to participate in your activities, even indirectly.
Pellerette said, This is an argument over nothing, my dear chap. I am no more anxious than you to have your privacy violated, nor mine, for that matter. Bliss and I will be discreet, won't we, Bliss?
It will be as you wish, Pell.
After all, said Pellerette, we are quite likely to be planet-bound for considerably longer periods than we will be spaceborne, and on planets, the opportunities for true privacy.
I don't care what you do on planets, interrupted Trevise, but on this ship I am master.
Exactly, said Pellerette.
Then, with that straightened out, it is time to take off.
But wait. Pellerette reached out to tug at Trevise's sleeve. Take off for where? You don't know where Earth is, nor do I, nor does Bliss, nor does your computer, for you told me long ago that it lacks any information on Earth. What do you intend doing, then? You can't simply drift through space at random, my dear chap.
At that, Trevise smiled with what was almost joy. For the first time since he had fallen into the grip of Gaia, he felt master of his own fate.
I assure you, he said, that it is not my intention to drift, Janoff. I know exactly where I am going.
Seven. Pellerette walked quietly into the pilot room after he had waited long moments while his small tap on the door had gone unanswered. He found Trevise looking with keen absorption at the starfield. Pellerette said, Golan, and waited. Trevise looked up.
Janoff, sit down. Where's Bliss?
Sleeping. We're out in space, I see.
You see correctly.
Trevise was not surprised at the other's mild surprise. In the new gravitic ships, there was simply no way of detecting takeoff. There were no inertial effects, no accelerational push, no noise,
no vibration.
Possessing the capacity to insulate itself from outside gravitational fields to any degree up to total, the far star lifted from a planetary surface as though it were floating on some cosmic sea. And while it did so, the gravitational effect within the ship, paradoxically, remained normal. While the ship was within the atmosphere, of course, there was no need to accelerate, so that the whine and vibration of rapidly passing air would be absent. As the atmosphere was left behind, however, acceleration could take place, and at rapid rates, without affecting the passengers. It was the ultimate in comfort, and Trevise did not see how it could be improved upon until such time as human beings discovered a way of whisking through hyperspace without ships, and without concern about nearby gravitational fields that might be too intense. Right now, the far star would have to speed away from Gaia's sun for several days before the gravitational intensity was weak enough to attempt the jump.
"Golan, my dear fellow," said Pellerat, "may I speak with you for a moment or two? You are not too busy."
"Not at all busy. The computer handles everything once I instruct it properly. And sometimes it seems to guess what my instructions will be and satisfies them almost before I can articulate them."
Trevise brushed the top of the desk lovingly.
Pellerat said, "We've grown very friendly, Golan, in the short time we've known each other, although I must admit that it scarcely seems a short time to me, so much has happened. It's really peculiar, when I stop to think of my moderately long life, that half of all the events I have experienced were squeezed into the last few months, or so it would seem. I could almost suppose..."
Trevise held up a hand. "Janoff, you're spinning outward from your original point, I'm sure. You began by saying we've grown very friendly in a very short time. Yes, we have, and we still are. For that matter, you've known Bliss an even shorter time, and have grown even friendlier."
"That's different, of course," said Pellerat, clearing his throat in some embarrassment.
"Of course," said Trevise. "But what follows from our brief but enduring friendship?"
"If, my dear fellow, we are still friends, as you've just said, then I must pass on to Bliss, whom, as you've also just said, is peculiarly dear to me."
"I understand. And what of that?"
"I know, Golan, that you are not fond of Bliss. I know, Golan, that you are not fond of Bliss. But for my sake, I wish..."
Trevise raised a hand. "One moment, Janoff. I am not overwhelmed by Bliss, but neither is she an object of hatred to me. Actually, I have no animosity toward her at all. She's an attractive young woman, and even if she weren't, then for your sake I would be prepared to find her so. It's Gaia I dislike."
"But Bliss is Gaia."
"I know, Janoff. That's what complicates things so. As long as I think of Bliss as a person, there's no problem. If I think of her as Gaia, there is."
"But you haven't given Gaia a chance, Golan. Look, old chap, let me admit something. When Bliss and I are intimate, she sometimes lets me share her mind for a minute or so. Not for more than that, because she says I'm too old to adapt to it."
"Oh, don't grin, Golan. You would be too old for it, too. If an isolate, such as you or I, were to remain part of Gaia for more than a minute or two, there might be brain damage. And if it's as much as 5 or 10 minutes, it would be irreversible. If you could only experience it, Golan."
"What? Irreversible brain damage? No, thanks."
"Golan, you're deliberately misunderstanding me. I mean just that small moment of union. You don't know what you're missing. It's indescribable. Bliss says there's a sense of joy.
That's like saying there's a sense of joy when you finally drink a bit of water after you have all but died of thirst. I couldn't even begin to tell you what it's like. You share all the pleasures that a billion people separately experience. It isn't a steady joy. If it were, you would quickly stop feeling it. It vibrates, twinkles, has a strange pulsing rhythm that doesn't let you go. It's more joy, no, not more, it's a better joy than you could ever experience separately. I could weep when she shuts the door on me.
Trevise shook his head. You are amazingly eloquent, my good friend, but you sound very much as though you're describing pseudoendorphin addiction, or that of some other drug that admits you to joy in the short term at the price of leaving you permanently in horror in the long term. Not for me. I am reluctant to sell my individuality for some brief feeling of joy.
I still have my individuality, Golan.
But for how long will you have it if you keep it up, Genov? You beg for more and more of your drug until eventually your brain will be damaged. Genov, you mustn't let Bliss do this to you. Perhaps I had better speak to her about it.
No, don't. You're not the soul of tact, you know, and I don't want her hurt. I assure you, she takes better care of me in that respect than you can imagine. She's more concerned with the possibility of brain damage than I am. You can be sure of that.
Well, then, I'll speak to you. Genov, don't do this anymore. You've lived for 52 years with your own kind of pleasure and joy, and your brain is adapted to withstanding that. Don't be snapped up by a new and unusual vice. There is a price for it. If not immediately, then eventually.
Yes, Golan, said Pellerat in a low voice, looking down at the tips of his shoes. Then he said, suppose you look at it this way. What if you were a one-celled creature?
I know what you're going to say, Genov. Forget it. Bliss and I have already referred to that analogy.
Yes, but think a moment. Suppose we imagine single-celled organisms with a human level of consciousness and with the power of thought, and imagine them faced with the possibility of becoming a multicellular organism. Would not the single-celled organisms mourn their loss of individuality and bitterly resent their forthcoming enforced regimentation into the personality of an overall organism? And would they not be wrong? Could an individual cell even imagine the power of the human brain?
Trevise shook his head violently. No, Genov, it's a false analogy. Single-celled organisms don't have consciousness or any power of thought. Or if they do, it is so infinitesimal it might as well be considered zero. For such objects to combine and lose individuality is to lose something they have never really had. A human being, however, is conscious and does have the power of thought. He has an actual consciousness and an actual independent intelligence to lose, so the analogy fails.
There was silence between the two of them for a moment, an almost oppressive silence. And finally, Pellerat, attempting to wrench the conversation in a new direction, said, why do you stare at the view screen?
Habit, said Trevise, smiling wryly. The computer tells me that there are no Gaian ships following me, and that there are no Seychellian fleets coming to meet me. Still, I look anxiously, comforted by my own failure to see such ships, when the computer sensors are hundreds of times keener and more piercing than my eyes. What's more, the computer is capable of sensing some properties of space very delicately, properties that my senses can't perceive under any conditions. Knowing all that, I still stare.
Pellerat said, Golan, if we are indeed friends, I promise you, I will do nothing to grieve Bliss. At least, nothing I can help. It's another matter now. You keep your destination from me, as though you don't trust me with it. Where are we going? Are you of the opinion you know where Earth is?
Trevise looked up, eyebrows lifted. I'm sorry. I have been hugging the secret to my own bosom, haven't I?
Yes, but why?
Trevise said,
Why indeed? I wonder, my friend, if it isn't a matter of Bliss.
Bliss? Is it that you don't want her to know?
Really, old fellow, she is completely to be trusted.
It's not that. What's the use of not trusting her? I suspect she can tweak any secret out of my mind if she wishes to. I think I have a more childish reason than that. I have the feeling that you are paying attention only to her and that I no longer really exist.
Pellerat looked horrified. But that's not true, Golan.
I know, but I'm trying to analyze my own feelings. You came to me just now with fears for our friendship, and thinking about it, I feel as though I've had the same fears. I haven't openly admitted it to myself, but I think I have felt cut out by Bliss. Perhaps I seek to get even by petulantly keeping things from you. Childish, I suppose.
Golan.
I said it was childish, didn't I? But where is the person who isn't childish now and then? However, we are friends. We've settled that, and therefore I will play no further games. We're going to Camporeon.
Camporeon, said Pellerat, for the moment not remembering.
Surely you recall my friend, the traitor, Munli Kampor. We three met on Seychelles.
Pellerat's face assumed a visible expression of enlightenment.
Of course I remember. Camporeon was the world of his ancestors.
If it was. I don't necessarily believe anything Kampor said. But Camporeon is a known world, and Kampor said that its inhabitants knew of Earth.
Well then, we'll go there and find out. It may lead to nothing, but it's the only starting point we have.
Pellerat cleared his throat and looked dubious.
Oh, my dear fellow, are you sure?
There's nothing about which to be either sure or not sure. We have one starting point, and however feeble it might be, we have no choice but to follow it up.
Yes, but if we're doing it on the basis of what Kampor told us, then perhaps we ought to consider everything he told us. I seem to remember that he told us most emphatically that Earth did not exist as a living planet, that its surface was radioactive, and that it was utterly lifeless. And if that is so, then we are going to Camporeon for nothing.
Eight. The three were lunching in the dining room, virtually filling it as they did so.
This is very good, said Pellerat, with considerable satisfaction. Is this part of our original terminus supply?
No, not at all, said Trevise. That's long gone. This is part of the supplies we bought on Seychelles before we headed out toward Gaia. Unusual, isn't it? Some sort of seafood, but rather crunchy. As for this stuff, I was under the impression it was cabbage when I bought it, but it doesn't taste anything like it.
Bliss listened, but said nothing. She picked at the food on her own plate gingerly.
Pellerat said gently, You've got to eat, dear.
I know, Pell, and I'm eating.
Trevise said, with a touch of impatience he couldn't quite suppress, We do have Gaian food, Bliss.
I know, said Bliss. But I would rather conserve that. We don't know how long we will be out in space, and eventually I must learn to eat isolate food.
Is that so bad? Or must Gaia eat only Gaia?
Bliss sighed.
Actually, there's a saying of ours that goes, when Gaia eats Gaia, there is neither loss nor gain. It is no more than a transfer of consciousness up and down the scale. Whatever I eat on Gaia is Gaia, and when much of it is metabolized and becomes me, it is still Gaia. In fact, by the fact that I eat, some of what I eat has a chance to participate in a higher intensity of consciousness, while, of course, other portions of it are turned into waste of one sort or another, and therefore sink in the scale of consciousness.
She took a firm bite of her food, chewed vigorously for a moment, swallowed, and said,
"It represents a vast circulation. Plants grow and are eaten by animals. Animals eat and are eaten. Any organism that dies is incorporated into the cells of molds, decay bacteria, and so on. Still Gaia. In this vast circulation of consciousness, even inorganic matter participates, and everything in the circulation has its chance of periodically participating in a high intensity of consciousness."
"All this," said Trevise, "can be said of any world. Every atom in me has a long history, during which it may have been part of many living things, including human beings, and during which it may also have spent long periods as part of the sea, or in a lump of coal, or in a rock, or as a portion of the wind blowing upon us."
"On Gaia, however," said Bliss, "all atoms are also continually part of a higher planetary consciousness of which you know nothing."
"Well, what happens then," said Trevise, "to these vegetables from Seychelles that you are eating? Do they become part of Gaia?"
"They do, rather slowly. And the wastes they excrete as slowly cease being part of Gaia. After all, what leaves me is altogether lacking in contact with Gaia. It lacks even the less direct hyperspatial contact that I can maintain thanks to my high level of conscious intensity. It is this hyperspatial contact that causes non-Gaian food to become part of Gaia, slowly, once I eat it."
"What about the Gaian food in our stores? Will that slowly become non-Gaian? If so, you had better eat it while you can."
"There is no need to be concerned about that," said Bliss. "Our Gaian stores have been treated in such a way that they will remain part of Gaia over a long interval."
Pellaret said suddenly, "But what will happen when we eat the Gaian food? For that matter, what happened to us when we ate Gaian food on Gaia itself? Are we ourselves slowly turning into Gaia?"
Bliss shook her head, and a peculiarly disturbed expression crossed her face. "No, what you ate was lost to us, or at least the portions that were metabolized into your tissues were lost to us. What you excreted stayed Gaia, or very slowly became Gaia, so that in the end the balance was maintained. But numerous atoms of Gaia became non-Gaia as a result of your visit to us."
"Why was that?" asked Trevise curiously.
"Because you would not have been able to endure the conversion, even a very partial one. You were our guests, brought to our world under compulsion, in a manner of speaking, and we had to protect you from danger, even at the cost of the loss of tiny fragments of Gaia. It was a willing price we paid, but not a happy one."
"We regret that," said Trevise. "But are you sure that non-Gaian food, or some kinds of non-Gaian food, might not in their turn harm you?"
"No," said Bliss. "What is edible for you would be edible to me. I merely have the additional problem of metabolizing such food into Gaia as well as into my own tissues.
It represents a psychological barrier that rather spoils my enjoyment of the food and causes me to eat slowly. But I will overcome that with time.
What about infection?